1, 2, 3.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 14th day of January. Very nice to have you with us on this Wednesday morning, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and it is, it's a day. it's a Wednesday, and here we are. We've got a great group just listening to the music of the Stevenson Ranch Davidians. They are playing Tubby's in Kingston on the 17th. Of January, which is this coming weekend. You can find out more by going, and I'm still mad about this because they stole my URL, tubbies.com. It's the Stevenson Ranch Davidians playing Tubby's on the 17th, and we'll be hearing that music from the Stevenson Ranch Davidians as we come into our breaks throughout this morning. All right, what else is happening? Well, we have a great group here. Before we get to that, let me just remind you that the fun drive is coming, and it's coming on February 2nd, and we are very excited to get ready for it. In the meantime, we're going to be in lockbox mode. We are in lockbox mode, and we welcome you to join us. This is a mechanism that helps us make money now, so we won't have to make money later. It's been an extremely popular and efficient way of making money, and just look at the last fund drive, which was just tremendous in that regard, and we're hoping to duplicate that, if not surpass it. The whole idea of this is to keep the programming that you love, that you listen to, that you support, that you give money for, on the air. So I don't have to tell you, there's a lot going on. And because there's a lot going on, we want that content to be on more than us asking for money. So to do that, we need you to do your thing now. If you do your thing, we do our thing, and we come back at the end of this, we'll have everything we need and be in good shape. So if you can help out, we appreciate it. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We love you for everything that you've done. You're doing great. Keep it up, and we'll march forward as we work without federal funding, but it's between all of us now, and we got to figure it out, and we're doing that, and whatever you can do to help, we greatly appreciate it. WAMC.org. All right, now comes my favorite part of the morning, where I get to introduce our panelists. We have a great group this morning. Let me talk to them. We have Ashley Dittus with us, the Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner. Good morning, Ashley. How are things in Ulster County?
Things are great in Ulster County. Tubby's is in Ulster County. I've been there numerous times. The last time I was at Tubby's, just to give you a little slice of life, Kingston, they were having we sort of have an amateur Simpsons historian in Ulster County, Alex Lario, shout out to her. She hosted a viewing of DMV-themed Simpsons episodes for our county clerk who ran last year, Taylor Brook.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
that's
it was brilliant. Great. I went. It was awesome. Some great DMV episodes over the years that The Simpsons has been on the air. So that was really a fun moment at Tubby's. So shout out to Tubby's.
That is fantastic. What a great idea. How really imaginative. That's wonderful. We also welcome the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Bob Griffin is here. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, Joe.
How are you?
Yeah,
Well, you know, I feel like my whole world is a DMV world. So just sitting, waiting to get called up and told that I don't have the right documents. So,
yeah,
it's kind of a theme.
You know, I had to go to the DMV in December. I had to go twice for two different reasons. And I allotted 90 minutes. I'm going to give myself 90 minutes. I was out in 12. Like, that's really good.
Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, that's really good. They had their act together. And here's something, and it happened to me twice. I went up to two different agents, and guess what? They smiled at me. Now, I smiled at them, and we bantered, but it was very nice. I just thought, you know, good on the DMV. I thought that was that was very fun.
Yeah.
But you could, you know, there's reasons people do sitcoms of the DMV.
Very true.
And Simpsons episodes.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot there. We welcome Jim Henler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Joe. I think I'll just leave it there.
All right. Yeah. I think we're all...
Actually, I should say one thing. Last week, I was on and I said something about agreeing with my wife on something.
Yes.
And talking about how she had been sort of thinking things were swinging far more dangerously than I was, and I thought she was becoming right, and she actually heard it, sent me a message saying, one, the fact that you agree with me on something is amazing, but even more so is the fact that now you've scared me because you used to be the one person who would always tell me I was wrong.
So
a shout out to this wonderful woman.
Yes, absolutely.
Almost 40 years.
Good for you. That's fantastic. Well, congratulations on that milestone, but also... yeah, that must be fun to gloat. Robert Pondicio is with a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Joe. And I guess I'm in a slightly more buoyant mood because as long as the Buffalo Bills are still alive in the playoffs, I have a reason to get out of bed in the morning.
I've said this on Monday and I'll say it again, but just that was one of the greatest weekends of football
really
that I've ever seen. It was just fantastic, with the possible exception of Monday night. But it was just a great, great weekend of football.
Yep.
And I can't wait to see what happens.
But I have a question for you about your DMV experience.
Yes.
Because every time I come up to do the roundtable, I think, oh, I need to go to the DMV because don't hate me, but I still don't have my real ID.
Oh, that's what I did. Yeah.
Okay, so it was only 12 minutes for that?
Well, it wasn't hard because now, in honesty, because of my wonderful wife, I had everything I needed.
All the documents.
She did it up for me. I had duplicates and all kinds of stuff. So as long as you go over the checklist,
all right.
It's pretty easy.
The big hurdle for me was getting my Social Security card, an actual physical copy. I hadn't seen it since I was 16 years old and working in a Taco Bell.
If you
I am not kidding.
I don't know the last time I saw my Social Security card, but
regardless, you have to have it.
Yeah,
right?
or something else. But like, in other words, a tax return with your Social Security number on it will work.
Okay.
Yeah. And no, once you have your stuff, you're great. Yeah, they
all right.
And they're very happy if you have your stuff and they don't have to explain
next
it.
Next time
you.
I come to do the roundtable, I'm going to DMV.
No, go to DMV. It's a wonderful experience.
Schedule an appointment.
It's good. Good people watching too. I'll leave it at that. Let's go to what's happening in the world, and there is a lot happening in the world, and too much, just too much. Oh, goodness, too much. And so we go to the subject of Iran. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, has hinted that a decision has been made on his part regarding Iran, as advisors meet to prepare strike options. He has been signaling assistance to anti-regime protesters. Some political allies remain cautious about attempting another high-risk operation or triggering a wider war. The president indicated that the time for negotiations with Tehran had passed, saying in a social media post Tuesday morning that he had canceled all meetings with Iranian officials, but some political allies are warning against the dangers of entanglement in another overseas conflict and the domestic costs of abandoning the America First policy, foreign policy that Trump campaigned on. The arguments against a strike include the danger of an accident or failure at the U.S. military and spy services attempt, more high-risk operations, as well as the possibility that the fall of the Iranian government could lead to a more militant regime or another failed state in the Middle East. That, according to former officials and people close to the White House, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. And this from the Washington Post. At the same time, the people said skeptics of a strike are hoping to avoid the open acrimony leading up to the U.S. bombing of Iran's nuclear sites in June, which stoked division in Trump's base over the wisdom of intervention in a Middle Eastern conflict and the meaning of, excuse me, of that America First slogan. Bob Griffin.
Oh, boy, Joe. You know, there are a couple elements I'll toss on the table and give the other panelists an opportunity to talk about it. The sort of the international implications of how we are using our military continues to be deeply disturbing to me. And we seem to be moving towards threats and use of force as a primary tool rather than a secondary or tertiary the way we used to. All of these conversations are always difficult because we get into the position of, well, you know, that means that you're supporting this corrupt regime. And let me just sort of put that on the table is that, no, I'm not. But I'd like to better understand where as a country we're moving and what comes next, because that continues to be a concern for me. If we do get involved in a situation in Iran and there is a regime change, what happens to that vacuum? And we saw what happened with Iraq. We've seen what happened in Afghanistan and in other places where we're not great at nation building. And I'll put another spin on this, Joe, is that my heart goes out to the folks in Iran who have lived under an oppressive regime that has used an internal security force, both formally and informally, to abridge any of the rights of the citizenry. I will note that it's not very different than what I'm seeing right now in the development of ICE and the ICE tactics. I will also put this right on the table for everybody. I think this more muscular use of the military is a reflection of what's going on in this country as much as it is what's going on in Iran, that as the economy continues to falter despite what Trump says about it being perfect, it's not. In fact, I think it's continuing to get worse. And when you see the missteps from his administration in places like Minneapolis, he needs to change the tenor and tone of the policy discussion, or he has no hope in the midterms. And when you start to talk about midterms, you have to talk about making changes now in order to impact what's going to go on in November. So this idea of, look, I'm a strong man. I've returned the United States to this global dominance, the use of the military, hoorah, support the troops. And the only way you can do that is by making sure that you put Republicans back into majority positions in both the Senate and the House, I think is as much part of the equation. The final thought, and I'll toss it out to everybody else, Joe, is I am really starting to question who is running our nation at this point in time. I'm looking at the cognitive decline. I'm seeing how Trump is operating, and I don't know if it's Miller. I don't know who's in charge of the levers of government right now, and that's a conversation that I think the press, especially the mainstream sort of major media press, is not doing enough reporting on.
Robert.
Thank you. Look, you know, maybe this makes me a bad roundtable panelist, but no part of my thinking about this right now is caught up in thoughts about the midterms or domestic politics whatsoever. I'm so captivated by this story, Joe, I have to say. You know, I've been wearing out the internet looking for any snippet of information, you know, hour by hour into the afternoon as night falls in Iran, looking for, you know, news, credible news about what's happening on the streets. You've got men and women in Iran risking their lives in the face of things that would be unimaginable to us here in the U.S. Internet blackouts, mass arrests, lethal force, estimates as high as 12,000 protesters killed by the regime. You know, this is not performative social media activism. These are people confronting a violent, oppressive, entrenched theocratic regime with real stakes and real consequences. Their lives are literally on the line. So, I mean, you know, the domestic politics, as far as I'm willing to comment on it, Trump has said, what was his word? Help is on the way. Well, okay, where is it? And they need it. If there was ever a case for intervention, military or otherwise, on behalf of a protest movement, I can't think of a better one in recent years. I mean, if the Iranian regime falls, it will be one of the most important world-changing events of this century. I mean, I'm struck that I can't think of anything that would surpass it. 9/11, maybe the COVID epidemic. That's about it. But having said that, help is on the way. I think we are morally required to offer that help and to do it quickly.
So, do you think we should have boots on the ground then?
Well, that's interesting.
What does help look like to you?
That's an interesting thing because, you know, and look, you know, foreign policy is and statecraft is not my forte. But I'm struck by how so much of the conventional wisdom about Iran and foreign intervention in general has simply been wrong in the last couple of decades. I mean, I remember one of the justifications for the JCPOA, the Iranian nuke deal, is, well, we can't possibly force them to abandon their nuclear program. We can't. If we put boots on the ground, it would require, you know, 100,000 dead American GIs, etc. Well, what we saw with the strike on the nuclear compound several months ago was a closed-end, very targeted intervention that took 39 hours, and it was over. Not a single American life was lost. I commented on this on the roundtable last week. Like, you know, the guys who did it came home the next day and took their kids to soccer practice. So where were all those folks who were, you know, who were promising doom and gloom if we did this? So I'm not minimizing the possibility. I'm just saying that we have to be open to the potential that the worst scenarios that war planners make for this may not come to pass.
Sure. One final question, and I'll turn it over to the other panelists. So given your logic, then, do you believe that we should be in the Ukraine then? Don't you feel that we should, if you're going to use your logic, then we should be also supporting the Ukraine?
Well, I do support Ukraine, but I mean, I also think that it's a different country, different set of circumstances. This is not a direct response to your very good question, but the other thing, Joe, that I'm struck by in watching this unfold is where are all the human rights protesters? Why, you know, not that long ago, we were seeing protests standing up for the people of Gaza who were oppressed. You know, what you just described was people being oppressed and killed in boxcar numbers by a regime. Why are we not seeing campus protesters and others coming out and supporting the Iranians right now?
Ashley. Mm-hmm.
I do think that this is, unlike Venezuela, I think that this is going to end up being handled more in the diplomatic channels. I think that Israel and the Saudis have expressed, you know, a little bit of pumping the brakes on military action. They don't want to destabilize the region. And I think that might be, we haven't really seen that. Of course, that would be against the pattern that we have seen. But I think that is what is being pushed behind the scenes. At least that's my read of what we get in the media. I also just want to echo that, you know, we are seeing these protests. I will note that a lot of this has been pushed by the women of Iran, which is commendable. The people of Iran have a very different opinions about ideology than the people that are running their country right now. They are very active on social media, which is they see what other, not just other Western countries, but what other Muslim countries, Turkey, for example, how their lives are. And this has been bubbling for the last, you know, few years. The younger generation is who's standing up and unfortunately putting their lives at risk by doing so. So I think that that is commendable. These people are extremely brave in doing so. We do, as a country that, you know, still, I think, believes in spreading democracy. I would like to believe. I mean, of course, that's being tested right now. But I think that this is something that we should be involved in. I do think, though, that it's not going to be an automatic military strike. I also think that our military is sort of stretched out thin right now with all the actions in the Caribbean and mobilizing people and moving them to those areas. That might be might take some time. So I think let's have some talking and diplomacy and stop these killings of protesters, hanging of protesters. Turn the internet back on, so get the media in there so that we can see what's going on and get them the humanitarian help that they need.
Jim Handler.
So I guess there's two aspects of this I'd like to point out. One is, I guess it was around 2008, I heard a talk by Bill Bradley, the at that point former senator as well as former basketball player. I have a picture of me and my wife next to Bill Bradley. Boy, is he tall.
Yeah.
But anyway, the thing he was saying about Iran is that they were predicting it to fall due to internal tensions within the next few years, and that that was really a reason why the U.S. could stay out. And I've heard that repeated over and over and over again. And I think it's taken a lot more building. I think the willingness of the regime to, you know, to really kill their own people and do these incredibly harsh things was underestimated. And part of that is, strangely enough, Iran was one of the few democratic countries in the region in the sense that they had fair elections for the president. Now, then the president didn't have a lot of control over certain parts of things, but some of the economics and things. And over time, that's eroded. The other thing is the birth rate has been high, so that the number of younger people who are willing, you know, again, you look back at the Vietnam protests, maybe even the Gaza protests, it wasn't a whole bunch of 60 and 70-year-olds hanging around saying, you know, we're out on the streets. It was, you know, kids who were in the encampments. It was when I was getting beaten up by police. It was thousands of us marching on Wall Street. So, you know, these things build, but largely it's really college students' age that's where you see a lot of this. And now that has become a very large portion of the population of Iran. So I think that's one reason we're seeing more of this, and that's the one I applaud. But let
If I may, isn't there also a more of a tradition of secularism in Iran than other
nations? There had been.
Okay.
And then it got crushed away,
right,
partly because of U.S. interference. Let's not go back that far.
In the 50s.
And then, you know, I mean, Iran has been a thorn in the side of the U.S. for a very long time, partly because we were backing an authoritarian dictator in a country that wanted to move away from authoritarianism. Unfortunately, they moved away from authoritarianism into a different authoritarianism. The second point I want to make is that I don't think you can put parallels between Venezuela and Iran. So in Venezuela, we knew where the targets were. We had very specific people. You know, we can get into the reasons and the oil and stuff, but the actual military operation was, by military terms, not incredibly difficult, right? Iran is very different. The mullahs move around all the time. They've been, they've been worried for 20 years about Israel taking them out. Israel has been better than the U.S. at targeted strikes, at having the right kind of intelligence, things like that. So how do you help the protesters? You can't just start shooting missiles into Iran. That's going to take out protesters. That's not necessarily take out government. So I think that the notion that we could have some kind of small-scale targeted military operation in Iran is very questionable.
Did you just hint at the answer, though, Jim? In other words, you're absolutely right. I mean, Israel's intelligence and capabilities have been extraordinary. I mean, you know, targeting and assassinating nuclear scientists in their apartments, in hotel rooms with zero collateral damage, that kind of thing. If you combine that with whether you like it or not, the Venezuelan example of the U.S. military able to go into someone's home and bring him to the U.S. without suffering any U.S. casualties, doesn't that add up to, if I'm a mullah in Iran, I'm not getting a lot of sleep right now?
You may not be getting a lot of sleep right now, but that part of that is because you're moving your apartment every night. But
okay.
But again, these lived in Israel for a while, know a lot about their side of the story. I've obviously never lived in Iran. Well, I don't know if that's obvious, but I've never lived in Iran.
No, it's obvious.
Let's just say those of my religious persuasion are not always welcome in Iran. Most religious persuasions. But the clear thing that was really the issue there is that Israel has had the ability and has had times where they had a government that would be willing to do this. So there's been a belief that the Iranians have developed stuff to make this harder. Now, in recent years, and particularly in the strikes by Israel and then the U.S., a lot of that has been degraded, but it's very unclear that it's been degraded to the point that you would be able to do a military operation strategically. And, you know, the strange argument for that is the fact that because if they could have, Israel would have recently.
Yeah. What about a cyber attack like Stuxnet or some such?
You know, that'll turn over to Bob because he's one of the world's experts on that kind of stuff.
I mean,
show off, Bob.
Yeah. No, thanks, Jim. I mean, it's already ongoing, right? I mean, there's been sort of a state of a hot cold war with Iran for many many years. This is different. This feels different. It feels different than in and out. We're talking about a regime change. I think it would be naive to think that there's going to be a regime change that isn't going to get a reaction from one of Iran's closest allies in Russia. I don't know how the whole religious element of the Shia versus the Sunni is going to play out, and I will go back to something that I said earlier, and I'll keep asking the question, is that this administration is so transactional.
Yeah.
Okay. I continue to ask the question of what is the quid pro quo that is involved in our involvement in Iran?
Oil.
Yeah.
Okay. So there we go again. I mean, so let's just be upfront with that.
Political stability.
How can you argue political stability?
Iran has been a state-sponsored terrorist or a state sponsor of terrorism for decades. How can it be anything other than in the U.S. interest to have a different regime in Iran?
Well, and we said the same thing about Afghanistan, and we certainly haven't made that situation better. So if we're going to look at his history, at least our more recent, you know, historical context, I think we are potentially making similar mistakes.
But Afghanistan, if I may, and you're the expert, I'm not, but Afghanistan is not a sponsor. It is a client, as it were. Iran is the sponsor.
Well, I would argue that I think you're wrong in that.
Okay.
But we're happy to debate that with you.
Yeah, I think the whole situation is fairly complicated in that, in what the relations are and who has control. So, you know, there was a point where the Iranians were trying, they've been giving a lot of stuff to the Houthis.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to put a rein on some of the Houthi activity, and Houthi said no.
Right.
I will tell you the scariest thing I've seen, though, recently is just today, I believe it was, that Trump is now ordering some of our troops and particularly some of our diplomatic folks out of Qatar.
Yeah.
And, you know, if something's going to happen in Iran, that's a place where there would be reaction. And so that does scare me that this thing is really happening and not just the U.S. is threatening. Iran says, hey, you know, when they threatened to bomb our nukes, they did. They didn't get as much. Let's not go into whether that was successful or not. It wasn't, but it could conceivably have been. But the idea that we can somehow strategically take out the mullahs, leave a functioning, quote, democratic, unquote, government in there. In Venezuela, took out the leaders, and what did we immediately do? We let the same party stay in and keep doing things, just with the deal being that now that they're scared for their lives, they're going to be more compliant and let us have more oil. I don't think that is any way parallel to the political situation in the Middle East in particular.
So what do you do if you're the U.S.?
Well, I think you have to increase the sanctions. That's just, you know, sort of a knee-jerk reaction. But two is, I think, finding ways to support the protesters who actually, interestingly, you don't have which is hard because you don't have a centralized entity there, right? This is very much like the protests we're seeing in the U.S. and the sort of no kings and indivisible there, where just there was, you know, news last night showing 30, 40 different places around the U.S. where people were protesting what was happening in Minneapolis, and there was no single entity that was coordinating it. So how exactly you support protesters is not easy, but I think providing information, I think trying to cut some of the call a friend. So, you know, I think what Iran really will, I think what's going to happen is if these protests really keep growing, Iran then starts to call in favors from a lot of those terrorist agent organizations they've been supporting, and I think that's something we could by a combination of diplomacy and possibly targeted force control. There's a lot. You know, the problem I see is there's a lot of options, and I don't see a lot of good that would come out of a military option.
I guess I don't see the options as being that many or varied. I mean, these protests, correct me if I'm wrong, really the genesis of them was economic, the collapse of the rial and hyperinflation in Iran. So when you've got that kind of when that's the economic fact on the ground, as it were, then what do sanctions do but make a bad situation worse?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that's a potent lever in this instance.
Well, that's why I said that was the nature.
So it's easy to say.
I think it's isolation, and I think that's something we can do by a combination of, if we had a functioning diplomatic service at the moment, I think if we had things well under control in our own country, what we would be doing is looking at an isolation framework.
I'll tell you the most.
Let Iran fall by itself.
Well, Jimmy, you're on something too. Is that this is where the destruction of sort of the soft power elements of our foreign policy really bother me. That things like USAID and even the idea of being prepared to help a changed regime, which is going to require an awful lot of money.
Yes.
And a lot of resources, and those are conversations that, they can't even pass a budget. So how are we going to do this?
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Many letters to look at as well. We'll do that. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, discussing Iran and the decisions that are on the table, the options that are on the table for the president to consider, and national security advisors looking into this as well. And you've heard our panel. We have letters, and we'll continue our conversation with our group through these letters. We go to Andrew, who says, I can't help but think that we and or the Israelis are behind the currency devaluation in Iran in an effort to topple the government. This is really risky because the only thing worse than what they have now is a civil war with no idea of who would emerge. Libya? Anyone? The world is on fire. And we are the arsonists. That from Andrew.
I think there's a third player, though, you've got to toss into that. And Andrew's letter is very interesting. But I also think that there's a strange alignment with the Saudis in this as well. So it's not just the U.S. and Israel. It's also the Saudi government and the ruling class. And their tensions with Iran.
We go over to Russ, who says, I'm concerned that when the president says help is on the way, that our foreign policy has lost touch with the reality. Imposing further economic sanctions will just make the Iranians poorer, and bombing them is unlikely to be much help to anybody. Mr. Trump would be better occupied in trying to prevent his own security services from killing our own people.
Eli Lake on the commentary podcast yesterday made a very interesting observation. I guess he's been following this for quite some time. He pointed out that a number of the ruling elite in Iran have children and relatives here in the U.S., and he speculated, well, what would it look like if they were on the next plane back to Iran? Would that put diplomatic pressure on the move? In other words, do you want your – he cited somebody whose daughter, I guess, is teaching at Emory University or some such. I hope I'm getting that right. How would you feel if she were on the next plane back to Tehran?
Right.
So we're going to pull U.S. citizens.
No, she's not a U.S. citizen. She's an Iranian.
She's Iranian, but my understanding is she's green card holder, which we've always considered to be the equivalent of,
well,
may or may not have gotten full citizenship.
Right.
Yes,
right.
And so have many of their kids.
I'm merely saying is since we were speculating in the earlier segment, like, we all agree, support the protesters, but it's once that gets down to brass tacks, okay, what does that look like? Right. Then we kind of stare at our shoes and hem and haw about.
Well, see, I think, so I know we're in the letters portion, so I won't bring this up again, but here's the thing. We often talk about this, quote, supreme leader of Iran because there is such a person. But that person is actually much more like a large committee, right? So you have the top mullah. You have a group of, I think it's either 12 or 14. I used to know the actual numbers. And then you have a much larger group under that. Problem is, from our point of view, that's a very well-defined hierarchy. So it's not like you could just take out one. You know, in the U.S., if something happens to the president, right, our government doesn't instantly fall apart because we have succession planning that's very deep and very clear. So does Iraq on their religious side. So the state government is democratically elected, modulo the interference of the religious. But the actual rulemaking is mostly in the hands of that group. But that group it's not like a country where you have this one strong person government saying, you know, take that person out. So So arguably in Iraq, taking out Saddam Hussein immediately destabilized the whole country. Maybe too much, but that's a whole nother story. But in Iran, there isn't a single person like that that you would be able to take out. So I think that's the other aspect of this. And that's what scares me, because I feel like this government believes that most governments have a single person up top who makes the decisions, and don't really understand that that's a much more complicated case sometimes. And I think Iraq's a
I think your points are valid. I'd be very cautious. And, you know, we throw around the term that there's a democratic process there.
Yeah.
That it, and I don't want the listeners to.
Sorry,
to
yes.
It's a very, very controlled
yes.
process of who you are allowed to vote for. So,
yes.
yeah, you've got the right to go to the ballot box, but it's not like
yeah.
anybody there can run for office. There's a control mechanism that comes from the theocracy. So that's an important.
Sorry, if yeah. I didn't make it clear that was what I was trying to say, I apologize, because that's exactly right.
Well, I don't want listeners who to think that there's
right.
there's sort of like in the more Western traditions that we have enjoyed in the past of a democracy.
Right.
Well, it's different.
Yeah.
Back to the letters, Dolores says, and what if the Iranian regime doesn't fall? And if it does, we have a very bad track record with regime change. Please let's count our soldiers lost and debilitated in our regime change efforts in the past. That from Dolores.
Yeah, and Joe, could I just jump in on that? Because I think Dolores' point, and I think Robert's point, is really important. There are lots of options, and none of them are great. I mean, I think this is the challenge of any administration in these situations, is as much as you like to do something, as much as you like to support the demonstrators, you get, you know, 15, 20 different options, and they all stink. And sometimes the question is which stinks worse, and is the damage that you could potentially do by getting involved, even though you believe it to be the right, just, and moral thing to do, does it create more damage in the long run?
Robert, anything on that?
I'm just going to, at the risk of repeating myself, go back to what I said up top. I mean, if we're getting these reports and they're accurate, that north of 10,000 protesters have been murdered, and let's call it what it is. This is not a crackdown by the regime. This is the regime murdering its own citizens. If that's actively happening right now on the streets of Iran, then the house is on fire, so to speak. We don't have the luxury of time.
Let's see. Speaking of luxury of time, we have a break coming up, so let me see about getting another letter or two in. There is a direct line between the violence happening in Iran today and our USA, Canada, and Britain overthrow of the democratically elected prime minister in 1953 for nationalizing their oil industry, and the return of the Shah to power, and that from Joe in East Jewett. And one more. Actually, I think we'll stop there for the moment. When we come back, we'll continue other topics as well. We welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. And we would love to hear what is on your mind. Jim Hendler is here. Robert Pendicio, Bob Griffin, and Ashley Dittus all join us this morning. They make up our panel. We'll continue with this group and your letters after this short break. This life with a smile. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We're joined by Ashley Dittus, Robert Griffin, Jim Hendler, and Robert Pendicio, and it's a great pleasure to have you with us as well. Panel@WAMC.org if you would like to join us and get in on the letters, panel@WAMC.org. RG, and we would love to hear from you. Let me go to another issue, and we'll start this half hour talking about what is happening. Let's see. I would like to go to the Supreme Court on transgender athletes, because I think we can do this one fairly quickly as far as addressing it. Justices seem inclined to allow states to bar transgender athletes. The outcome of a pair of cases on Tuesday could affect laws in 27 states that prohibit transgender girls from joining girls' and women's sports teams. The Supreme Court's conservative majority on Tuesday seemed inclined to uphold a pair of state laws barring the participation of transgender athletes from girls' and women's sports teams. Excuse me. The outcome of the cases from West Virginia and Idaho has implications for the 25 other states with similar laws and for athletes who compete in school and collegiate sports around the country. Jim Handler.
So this one's a complicated issue for me, not because of.
I'm sorry, Judge. It's going to be easy, and we're going to be able to do this. Yeah. I was laughing at your optimism, Joe.
Because,
I was like, wow.
Because I certainly have personal familial connections. I don't have anyone transgender, but non-gender is another whole issue. But, you know, again, I think there were interesting questions asked. And, you know, the quick thing I'll say is it shows why sports is somehow, or it didn't really explain why sports is held so much higher in regard. But there were interesting questions. I think we may, what the people I've been listening to are saying is you'll probably see a fairly limited decision that allows the states to continue this because your only other choice would be to either make it legal everywhere or illegal everywhere. And the court didn't seem from their questioning to be ready to do that. So I'll just stop there. But, well, I'm almost stopped there. But there's a lot of other areas of life where there are supposedly physical differences, sometimes for real, sometimes debunked, male versus female, birth gender. And I think we just have to be careful that, you know, making a decision about sports is really, to me at this moment, a very, it's almost saying, since we know women are worse at sports than men, a transgender man, a transgender woman is not, is naturally going to be better. And that just is a strange argument if you try to apply it to other parts of social life and other parts of society where you have similar kinds of differences.
Robert.
I don't think it's that sports are held in higher regard. I think it's just where the differences are more visible. And the boundaries are clear. And frankly, the potential for injury, to be, you know, pragmatic about it. I mean, I'm the father of an athlete who probably got into the University of North Carolina largely as a result of Title I. She was a rower, and I joked for years that, you know, rowing in collegiate sports is the women's football team. You know, you've got to make up those numbers somewhere. So, you know, they have these massive rowing teams. You know, and again, I don't want to universalize my personal experience, but my daughter was, you know, a very tall and sturdy, strong athlete, and I remember watching her concuss a kid with a volleyball, like, you know, just hit a blast right off this poor young lady's dome. You know, suddenly if you've got a transgender athlete in the same circumstance, that might not just be a concussion. It could be something more debilitating. I mean, we've all seen these videos of, you know, the field hockey player who was, you know, who was born male, firing a shot into the kid's face and knocking out her teeth and whatnot. I mean, this is, for what it's worth, this is one of those, maybe, Joe, this is what you meant when you said we could dispatch this one quickly. I don't think either public opinion or science is on the side, frankly, of the transgender athlete in this case. Washington Post. I
just want to clarify, just because.
Sure.
I take this subject extremely seriously. My point was is that we don't have a court decision yet.
I see.
It was just a matter of the court listening to the case, and I wanted to address it and what we know in the early
stages. There are other cases which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in future roundtables that get to the issue of transgender rights in education, my bailiwick, that I think are going to be far more interesting and problematic than this one. There was an editorial in the Washington Post yesterday, and again, the Washington Post is not exactly a bastion of conservative opinion, that called on the Supreme Court, quote, to save women's sports by upholding these state laws that restrict participation in female sports based on biological sex. So I think the vast weight of opinion and science is frankly on one side here. But I take your point that I think you're probably going to see a narrow ruling here insofar as they will probably not rule on the contentious question of who is or is not a woman. But, you know, do states have the right to make these restrictions? To me, the biggest moment in this case yesterday, I didn't listen to all the arguments, but I listened to a bit of them, when Alito was questioning one of the plaintiffs and asked, well, what's the definition of sex? And she could not give an answer. And his response, my paraphrase, was, well, then how can we rule on a ruling that requires a definition of sex in order for us to weigh in?
Ashley.
Yeah, so I know politically that this is something that the Republican Party is very comfortable and happy to talk about because it's something that resonates with a certain portion of their voting base. This proxy for culture war about trans existence is something that we might see amplified as we get closer to the midterm elections, because it was a winning message in the presidential election. Famously, the ad where Trump is for you and the Democrats are for them is something that I think about often, especially surrounding this issue. I think the justices were not comfortable with this conversation, and I think that really showed in the dialogue, and that they really, I think it will be a limited ruling, but it will become, my prediction is, will become political fodder because it is a winning message within portions of the Republican base. Yeah.
But I will say I would be surprised if it's a 6-3 ruling in the conservative.
Yeah.
You would be? I won't, because I think it's going to be I think the comment that was made about being determined on a state's rights issue
that might be.
Rather than a biological issue. And this is the problem with a lot of these cases, is that while we're sort of interested in the social issues of the question, it really the law is a question of the state's rights of the ability of the states to put laws in place in these issues. I think one of the more interesting potential impacts of a decision, though, and Jim, you said you made a comment, and I just want to go back to it. I don't think women are worse at sports. I think there's physiological differences between the genders, and
as an average.
As absolutely. But what happens, you know, and I want to take the transgender issue and sort of not necessarily put it to a side or discount it, but, you know, we're entering an age when we're talking about modified human beings. Okay? I mean, this CRISPR technology is out there right now that is modifying human genetics. What happens when those athletes are creating a class of human beings that are going to be genetically modified to be better athletes? Okay, so how does this? I mean, so actually, as we talk about the transgender issue, to me, it's also this question of looking down the pipe at the societal impacts and the legal impacts of some of these scientific changes that are going on. How is this going to foreshadow? So, I mean, I think this is actually a really interesting case. I think at the end of the day, it's going to come down to a very very narrow ruling based on state and state rights rather than the conversations that we're having.
Yeah, I think it's going to be 8-1. I predict that Kagan and Sotomayor will discover their inner originalist on this decision.
All right. See, we did pretty good time on that. Yeah, not bad. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, panel at WAMC.org. Started a little rocky there, but we did all right. Panel at WAMC.org. Doug does say, just for comments, my understanding the idea of unfairness due to muscle and build was brought up by the judges, and while the attorney did not deny it can be an issue, but wasn't relevant to her client who did not have, quote, a typical male form. That from Doug. Okay, moving on to other issues. We go to the Minneapolis clashes that continue to go on. And 1 week after that event took place, the ICE shooting of a Minneapolis citizen. The video shows a young employee in a reflective vest being hauled away by federal agents from the entrance of a Target store in a Minneapolis suburb. I'm a U.S. citizen, the worker shouted as the armed agents shoved him into an SUV after he had directed expletives at one U.S. citizen, U.S. citizen. In and around Minneapolis in recent days, in quiet residential neighborhoods and busy shopping districts, at gas stations and big box store parking lots, similar chaotic scenes are unfolding. An escalation of tensions between residents and federal agents as the Trump administration intensifies its immigration crackdown in Minnesota after the killing of Renee Good by an immigration officer last week. Feels like our community is under siege by our own federal government, said State Representative Michael Howard, a Democrat whose district includes Richfield, where the Target employee and another colleague were seized on Thursday. Mr. Howard said both workers were U.S. citizens and were later released. The Department of Homeland Security said the Target worker seen in the video was arrested in connection with, quote, assaulting, resisting, and impeding federal officers. It was unclear on Tuesday if the employee had indeed been charged. That from the New York Times. Ashley.
Yeah, what we're seeing is horrific. I've seen the video that you just spoke about. I've also seen multiple videos of U.S. citizens who are engaging in these neighborhood protection efforts, engaging with ICE officers where ICE officers have their weapons drawn, where they also are referencing last week's murder of Renee Good as if saying things like, didn't you learn yet from last week? Don't you understand now that this is the force that we're going to bring to the community? It's extremely troubling, and I know we've been grappling with this for has it even been a week? It's a week today. So this is something that we're all seeing. I commend people that are brave to go out there and continue to film these interactions so that the rest of the country can observe what is going on. We still have the constitutional First Amendment right to speak out and to follow and film these interactions. And ICE agents they get 6 weeks of training. I think that this is harming our standard law enforcement agencies that then have to go and answer these calls and then become involved themselves in it. I was listening to the interview with the chief of police of Minneapolis where their 911 calls are off the charts, and that they are their resources are, you know, they're already down a significant amount of law enforcement officers, and they're having to go into and de-escalate these situations. So I'm curious to see what everybody else thinks about this, but I did see a poll that the Quinnipiac poll about ICE and how the opinion of the people polled anyway, is that now ICE has less of a positive opinion among most people. I think it was a factor of 47% people feel less safe. 82% of voters had seen the video. People that were polled had seen the video, and it's the first time that people now think that ICE should be abolished. There's more people, at least that were polled, that think that ICE should be abolished than should remain. I think that it should be abolished. I think that we should reallocate those resources to our standard law enforcement agencies in this nation. So that's what I've got.
Robert?
Wow. Joe, I'm going to be dead honest with you. I'm dreading this conversation, and I have been dreading it all morning. I've been, for those little, peek behind the curtain, Joe sends the articles the night before that we're going to discuss on the roundtable. And I kind of knew this was going to come up, and I was dreading it, and then there it was, and I've been thinking about it all morning. The reason I'm dreading this conversation is because I think the way that those of us who put opinions, into the ether for a living operate, we're required to have a point of view, and frankly, a tribal point of view. Our audiences expect that of us. And if you refuse to take sides, it does not gain you, forbearance or goodness knows credit for being fair. It makes it worse. How can you deny the evidence of your own eyes? You saw what I saw. Why do you not have my same point of view? Why are you apologizing for, fascism on the one hand, or, somebody who put herself in danger choosing to interfere with a law enforcement officer? I see this as I don't have a side here. I don't want to take a side on this issue. I was reminded of an essay. Sorry to kind of go down the rabbit hole here, but when I used to teach a high school civic seminar way back when, one of the way we did this course was it was basically about constitutional issues in the news. And one of the issues that came up while I was teaching this class was that case in New York City of Eric Garner. Remember that name? The guy who was killed for by police. He was selling loose cigarettes in Staten Island. And there was an incredible piece, an op-ed piece by a guy named Stephen Carter, who I think is a Yale University law professor at the time. And I'm just going to read the first paragraph of this now, 10-year-old essay. He wrote, "On the opening day of law school, I always counsel my first-year students never to support a law they are not willing to kill to enforce. Usually they greet this advice with something between skepticism and puzzlement until I remind them that the police go armed to enforce the will of the state, and if you resist, they might kill you." Well, isn't that what happened here? And this should force, I think, all of us to really question our own priors. Okay, you support ICE. Well, then you're putting people in a position, or you're putting them in a position where they may kill to enforce the thing you support. Oh, you support physically intervening to stop the enforcement of a law or an agency that you hold in high regard or view as illegitimate. Well, then you may be killed. Do we want to have this conversation or not?
Well, first of all, and I thank you for sharing your thoughtful perspective of not having a side on this. If it makes you feel any better, I dread having any of these conversations. Okay. I live in a constant state of dread.
Well, we could just stop talking.
Well, no, yeah. But I mean, that's the thing. I mean, some of this stuff is really hard to talk about, right? Because you're put into a corner of saying, well, how do you feel about it?
Yeah.
And some of it is much more complex than that and is difficult. So I appreciate your honesty.
Let me respond, because I think there are two issues that are getting conflated, right? One is the original event. I was going to say there could be legitimate disagreement about that event. I'm going to put scare quotes around the word legitimate in that. But I think the follow-up, what's going on now, the level of force being used by ICE, the fact that the federal government is sending in 1,000 more agents today, the fact that the federal government for the first time in I think possibly known history, Lawrence O'Donnell says, at least the past 50 years, is refusing to share information with the state about the actual event and about many of these follow-up events. You know, going off on a slight tangent, right, one of the things that's very different in Iran versus here is that here we have an open media and we have people who are allowed to have their own cameras and take pictures. Authoritarian governments want to shut that down. I think you've seen an attempt by the right-wing media channels to show very, very selective things. Now, whether the other side is also, we can argue about, but, you know, I think a few people out there may know I'm a fairly big supporter of public radio, like doing this. I think that it's our freedom to have these discussions. I think it's our ability to say, hey, we think the way this is being pursued is wrong, is crucial. And yeah. I think that the continued attempts by ICE to deny people who have the right to be out there videoing them, claiming they're pulling those people aside, they're pulling those people out. That scares me in some ways even more than the original incident.
Yeah, and the conversation to me is critically important because it's a conversation that we should have about what we believe to be the role of government in our society. And do we believe that law enforcement function should be able to, you know, when can it use force? Okay, and this is where we should be crafting laws around what we believe is the people of proper use of force. Do we believe that law enforcement should be able to hide their identity, or should they have to be able to identify yes. themselves? Do we believe that the you know what's the role of the federal government versus the state government? I appreciate the comments about ICE. I've said for a long time that. The functions of ICE need to continue, okay? Yeah. At the same time, I believe it has become a feral organization, and it has developed well beyond what its intended purpose was. And I can tell you from my time at DHS where, you know, ICE and the different elements are completely different than where it is today. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think there are too many resources. I think there is too few controls. I think the fact that there at the federal level there isn't even a willingness to have an investigation into what the facts are here is criminal and negligent on behalf of the leadership of the Department of Justice and certainly the Department of Homeland Security. I also personally feel that this is purposely meant to inflame and continue to divide the nation. The idea that we're not going to try to de-escalate the situation, we're going to move more resources in there. And again, ICE's role, you know, remember what ICE's role is. ICE is not really supposed to be law enforcement. It's supposed to be in immigration control. And they're on the streets in ways that I think are anathema to what this country stands for. I don't believe, Robert, that this country, that you should fear to walk down the street. I don't believe that I should have to be prepared to show my papers. I don't believe that this is the role of the federal government. I don't believe that my tax dollars should be going to this. And I think these are all conversations that we have to have. The other point, though, and I think this is really important, this isn't a partisan issue for me. This is
30-second warning. Go ahead.
This isn't a blue or red. This isn't a Democrat or Republican. This is the fact that what do we believe as a nation we should be following?
All right. We'll pause there. We'll continue pick this up on our way back. We'll have another half hour of discussion. We include you as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we welcome your conversations. Last call for the letters if you would like to be considered this morning. Meanwhile, we'll go over to news, and here within the studio, we'll just let the dread simmer. Good morning. Welcome back to the program and to the roundtable. Apologize, we had some issues with the BBC that was going in and out, so we apologize for that. Hopefully, we'll contact the British folks and see what they're up to, and hopefully they'll get it resolved by our next time together. Let's see. We have some comments here. Does anybody else want to say anything before we go to the letters?
Sure. I'll make a quick comment. Just responding to something Bob said about, you know, we need rules around use of force. Well, we have them. I think that's what made Stephen Carter's column so powerful to me, you know, a decade or so ago, that, you know, all enforcement carries with it the potential for lethal force, and we just have to be clear-eyed about that. Now, you know, the argument obviously is whether or not it was justified in this or any case, but it's not as if we don't have rules around that. My concern, there was a terrific column yesterday in the Free Press by a woman named Kat Rosenfield, who, and I wish I was half the writer that she is, she pointed out something that I had eluded me, even though I've watched all these videos like everybody else has. At one point after Rebecca Good was shot, somebody yells out, and it was apparently her wife, "Why did you have real bullets?" Which is chilling. That's in other words, that suggests just, you know, and I want to minimize this. It suggests sort of a cosplay aspect to this. Like this is not real. You know, like this is, but it is real. Obviously, it's real. How could you, now, you know, obviously you shouldn't read too much into a spontaneous utterance like that. But it just chilled me to the bone when I read that comment. Like, how could you not understand what you were getting yourself into?
I mean, isn't that a version? I understand what you're saying, but isn't that a version of why didn't they shoot at the tires?
Well, maybe so. Yeah. Maybe so. Well, I want to go back to what I said up top, which is I don't want to take sides in this because I think it was just a tragedy and a cascading series of events that obviously ended in a death. But I mean, we've got to be sober about these things. We have to exercise restraint on the one side and understand what we're walking into on the other. The stakes are enormous. And my biggest misgiving about this, Joe, is that we do this reflexively anyway. You know, every news event becomes an exercise in confirmation bias. And now the stakes are getting higher. And at some point, responsible people have to step back.
You know. But I think there are a couple issues here. One is that there are rules in place, but we need to have a thorough investigation into whether those rules were followed.
Absolutely.
Okay. We also have to have a thorough investigation into, are the rules correct?
Absolutely.
Are the rules of engagement correct? Are there other ways that as a governmental entity we should have performed this function, ensuring both the safety and security of the officers, but also recognition of the constitutional rights? These are all issues that this should be triggering, and I don't feel like it is. I also continue to feel that it is our obligation as citizens to continue to question the government.
Amen.
That the government needs to be held to the highest standard possible, because we are the government. Okay, and that's what this is what gets me is that I feel like even some of the most basic investigations that should be ongoing right now are being blocked by the government.
But do you take my point, though, that we are we've fallen into the habit as a society of immediately going into our respective camps, indulging our priors, and seeing deadly serious events as battles between good and evil and the heroes and the villains.
So,
and we're just not well served.
So, well, I agree with you to some degree.
I'll take it.
And I wasn't going to go this far back, but in 1967, at the Democratic Convention,
the year of my birth,
the protests became a. It is now referred to as the police riot.
Right, in Chicago.
Chicago.
Right.
The police riot.
That's
in
right,
Chicago.
Right.
And probably the biggest difference there was that it was all with state, and now we're talking federal, and that changes things drastically. But you look back at that, and virtually everybody who looked at it in retrospect said the overreaction was part of what caused the situation to get violent. The fact that the police, rather than de-escalating, decided to escalate. Well, and I fear that's what's happening in Minneapolis.
And this is where I think, Robert, you're absolutely correct, is that what scares me for this country and for the future of this country is the fact that we need to be able to come together to review the situation. And you're right, we definitely have camps. But I also look at again, government. And the idea that DHS is now sending thousands more troops into the city, into an inflamed situation, they're doing nothing to de-escalate that. And again, it feels dirty. Okay, it feels like again that the administration is purposely creating chaos in the streets in order to further their own personal goals, and it's not what's good for the people, it's not what's good for the country, it's what's good for the people in power, and that's a bad model for this country.
I have to say, though, I'm fascinated by this topic, and I'm so glad you brought it up, Robert, because I think it's something that's been weighing on me. I wish I had confirmation bias. Like, I wish I was that sure about one way or the other.
Oh, amen.
I can't do that. I have trouble. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem. We want to know. We want to have a conclusion. But it's really hard under these circumstances to come to any meaningful conclusion, which I think is what leads to the dread you talked about before. Because I do these mental gymnastics daily where I think to myself, okay, well, this happened and this happened and this happened. Oh, but this woman is dead.
Yeah.
You know, and it's things like that that just keep coming back to me and back to me and back to me. And I don't think it's right, but, you know, for people who have, like, this is the right thing to do. Well, man, okay, you got one on me because I have no idea what's right anymore. I wish I did. Mm-hmm. I know what I feel. I know how I react. Mm-hmm. But man, I don't have that solid a sense of true confirmation that how I feel is the right way to feel.
Well, amen. And may there be more of us, because I think the mischief comes with those who are absolutely certain about one way or the other, because then we will just continue to have these kinds of events.
I agree with you. But, you know, when you look at the fact that a set of the top prosecutors who would normally be the ones to be exactly doing what you said, figuring out what happened, getting all the facts, determining the entirety of what happened, have just resigned because they've been told you're not allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, this is, to me, again, scary, because it's saying that those things that we have put in place so that we would not become a confirmation bias-based world are now being threatened at a structural level. And I've always had great faith in that structure. I've been involved in committees where I was the only Democrat. I've been in committees, you know, government, high-level determinations of what the government was going to do in various national security situations and things like that. And it was always done based on everybody put your party affiliation aside and let's look at the facts. And the fact that you now have a situation this inflammatory and are being told, sorry, we're not allowed to look at the facts. That's right. What scares me.
But follow that idea where it leads, okay? You also have organized efforts of people who are questioning the I'm not taking a side here, questioning the legitimacy of immigration enforcement and making a decision that they are physically going to intervene. Well, that's how is that different than prosecutors saying, if I can't do my job? In other words,
So this was the group whose job it has always been to make sure that state law enforcement, that any law enforcement agencies, mm-hmm. but particularly that the law enforcement agencies in a state are following the federal policies with respect to appropriateness. And that's what's not being allowed. And I'll stop there.
No, you don't have to. But I do think that when you started giving your answer, you said, let's go back to the original event. And I think that is also what we're talking about. We have to piecemeal this. We can't just say, this is how I feel, and have that be a constant as things change, as different decisions are made. I also don't want to give the impression that I don't get really angry and upset by all of this. I do. But I think a lot of that has to do with I just don't really often, which I think many of us do, don't quite know how to process it all in one time. And that's just one issue, not to mention the 40 others that you know that are arm wrestling for your time and attention and a little brain space.
And I think your point's really, really valid, Joe. And for me, it's a question, you know, Robert, how do we balance? And it becomes this question of balance, right? So how do we balance the implementation of our laws, okay, the upholding our laws with this idea that there should be transparency about how things are being done? And if in the fear that actually government isn't even following the laws that are in place. Yeah. And if they're not following the laws that are in place, then who is watching and who is telling? Yeah. So what we're seeing is a continued breakdown in faith in the media, a continued breakdown in faith in our institutions, a continued breakdown in our faith in the laws. And the feeling is that we are, you know, I feel like the seams have frayed to the point where it's a really dangerous situation. Yeah. And this gets back to sort of the comments earlier about Iran. What is the difference between what's going on in Iran versus what's the difference between what's going on in some of our cities right now?
Yeah, and I think and this isn't a cheap joke, but but it's not like a breakdown of this or a breakdown of that. I mean, I feel like I'm close to just a breakdown. Like I mean, there's just so much that you're processing and trying to make sense of to understand. I think all of us on this panel have an equal goal. We're trying to be articulate on the matters and try to add to a discussion. So there is that onus that is put on all of us. But that's the part, you know, where you feel like, okay,
but
now
it's
what
even,
do we do?
But it's even more frustrating than that, if I could. The fact that things that shouldn't happen, like the idea that we're going to withhold money for kids' lunches in blue states only.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, that's not what this country is about.
And mental health.
Okay. This idea that, you know, for me, it was like, you know, you think about disaster relief, okay? It wasn't red or blue. It's what do we have to do to help other elements of the country get back on their feet, because that's what we do as good people, which we do as a moral country. I mean, the feeling, and I think the anger that I have at the current administration and the folks in Congress on both sides of the aisle is, you're in a very short period of time, you have destroyed some of the foundational pieces of this country, and I don't know how we rebuild those.
If I can attempt to put a bow on this conversation, I guess, and I agree with much of what you just said, I think what we are having here is a crisis of legitimacy. I think that's the through line for all of this.
Yeah.
And it's not just governmental, it's all institutions.
Yes.
And that creates a permission structure to not just disregard the guidance or, yes, the law, but almost a freelance in a sense. Like when institutions collapse, when we have this crisis of legitimacy, I'm on my own, and I'm going to act in a way that satisfies my own instincts and priors.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back.
I go to sleep to get away.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. And we appreciate all of you being with us and participating. We have time for another topic, and we'll finish out on this morning as we talk about, well, many issues this morning. As we say, there's a lot, and there's a lot to get a hold of. So we look to the midterms and the where we are in 2026, and we've talked some about this, and I think it's good to check in. And of course, we have Ashley with us, who is a Board of Elections commissioner in Ulster County. So I wanted to bring up the issue of some of the concerns that are out there. Democrats raising worries about Trump interfering in the midterms. The White House calls it fear-mongering. It is, if history is a guide, Republicans stand a good chance of losing control of the House in 2026. They have just a slim majority in the chamber, and the incumbent party usually gives up seats in midterm elections. President Donald Trump, whose loss of the House halfway through his first term led to two impeachments, is trying to keep history from repeating, and doing so in ways his opponents say are intended to manipulate next year's election landscape. Earlier this week on the program, I believe it was this week, Dr. Karen Riedel, who was our guest, said there will be elections. They may just look different than they have in the past.
There will be elections, and they won't look different than they have in the past when you go to the poll site. The machines are the same. The ballots that you get are the same. I will say we might have two-page ballots because we're consolidating some of our elections in New York State, so that might be something different. But what you will not see is police presence, or certainly not ICE presence at your poll sites, which is a concern I know that was raised in this article. But we have, as election commissioners, have been discussing this and other items for a very long time. We just had a conference last week, and in New York State, so your listeners know, it's a bipartisan election structure that we have here in New York. So I am the Democratic commissioner. I have a Republican counterpart, and we work together to set the policies of the Ulster County Board of Elections. That is replicated across the state. And so some of the flexes, though, that we have seen from the federal government that do concern us are the Department of Justice asking for protected records from many states, including New York, that would include Social Security numbers, which in New York state law we are not permitted to give out. So we've also seen Department of Homeland Security come into boards and file subpoenas asking for specific voter records. That happened at my board in September of last year. We've also heard of federal agents, FBI agents, going to the homes of voters who have voted in past elections asking about their mail-in ballots. I have been working in elections for, this will be my 16th year, and that, I can tell you, is something we have never seen before until this last 12 months, because we're almost a year into the Trump administration. So that is what we are concerned with, but we make plans for that. We in Ulster have an emergency, a great relationship with emergency management, and we have a command center in our office during the early voting and the election day, just in case something happens. There is a law that I support in New York that would, in fact, if there is a situation, whether that's interference or an emergency that happens at a poll site and it disrupts the election for an amount of time, it would take that amount of time and it would add it to the end of the election so that the poll sites could remain open. That's something that we're discussing right now that could potentially get passed before the midterm elections in November. It is a concern, but I also don't want voters to be afraid to vote. They have the right to vote. They can serve as election inspectors or poll watchers if they want to be a part of the process to ensure that all of our laws and the way that we conduct elections is not altered or changed. Thankfully, the president can't just change how the elections are run because they're state-based. He has signed executive orders. Those executive orders are unlawful. Congress, there's a very high threshold for them to change the rules of elections in all of the states. Election machines are safe and secure. I know that that pops up a lot. In the Times interview that Trump did last week or a couple of days ago, he said he had regrets about not deploying the National Guard to seize election machines. Right. I don't know, as an election administrator, how that would work, since I am responsible for the custody and care of those ballots and those machines throughout the election up through the certification process. So while there's a lot of these things that are out there, and I'm sure they're scaring your listeners, and they certainly scare the voters that I talk to, nothing has changed. You can still register to vote. You can still cast your ballot by mail. You can still access these things. We do have postmark issues that have popped up, that we're creating messaging so that our voters who do mail their ballots in understand how their ballot can come in and for us to canvass it. So that's the kind of thing that I'm working on with, I will say, full bipartisan cooperation from my counterpart and across the whole state. We just had a conference last week. These are things that we talk about for days and days on end. We have constant engagement. The State Board of Elections is a very great resource to all the county boards. And I know it's scary, but that's the intent. There are people that want to scare voters so that they do stay home and that they do not vote. I've had voters who are naturalized citizens that have expressed apprehension to me. They don't want to sign petitions to allow candidates to appear on the ballot. They're afraid that that will raise a red flag and that they will be looked at. We try our best to calm those fears, because we try to run the most transparent board that we can, let people know what all of their rights are, and help them to the highest degree. We even, in our county, we even go to the jail and we help voters who are eligible to vote, who are serving either misdemeanors or awaiting trial. So we have that relationship too. We do as much community outreach as we can so that we can constantly push back against these narratives that are out there that make people, like we said before in earlier conversations, have distrust in institutions like your election institutions.
Can I ask Ashley a question?
Sure.
Because to me, you know, there's no greater sin in civic life than delegitimizing elections. I don't care if you're on the left or the right. That is a third rail thou shalt not touch. So I'm really curious how you'll answer this question, because I don't know how to think about it, because I don't have your expertise. How, in your own mind, do you draw the difference between a measure that is designed to reassure and a measure that is designed to intimidate?
So the measures that are designed to intimidate are really hard to grapple with.
If I can just be clear, because I can see it where in some people's minds, what you and I might say is intimidation, somebody else might interpret as reassurance.
Is reassurance. Yeah, we deal with that specifically with, I deal with that a lot with voter ID questions. People come to our poll sites, why aren't you asking us for ID? That is one that comes up and has come up throughout my whole career. We are not allowed as the poll workers to ask somebody for ID unless there's specific reasons that we do. So that is the way that we deal with that, is that we refer them to their legislators. We're like, this is a legislative process. There are ways to change the law. We have significantly in New York changed the laws in the last 5 years since 2019. The landscape for elections has completely changed from then till now. And there is ways to make it better and to improve. So we look for feedback. We're going to be doing in this November election some exit polling with students so that they can ask people what their experience is like, what they don't like, because that informs the conversations that we have as commissioners with legislators to change those rules, to make them improve for the voter experience, to make people more confident in casting their ballot.
We're going to have to hold it there, and we're out of time. But my thanks to everyone for a very good discussion. And to Daniel, the listener who wrote that this is one of the most dystopian and depressing roundtables I've ever heard. I don't disagree, but...
Well, my job is done here.
Job
today.
Well done, exactly. Congratulations. You've all done well.
Wasn't dead air time.
Yes, good. we'll continue right after this.